The following podcast contains mature content, and the views expressed are not that of the studio, its partners, or even the performers.
Is out of town on business, so he's unable to record today. So it's just you and me guest hosting on a two-person guest host show.
Perfect.
But it should be good, because just like old times, right? It's been...
Indeed.
We've known each other well for like 4 years now, 5 years.
Yeah, man. I mean,
easily
I think it was 2011
years.
When we met. Like, yeah,
maybe six. Yeah, it puts it 7 years. Wow. The time flies.
Dang.
The days drag,
indeed,
but the years fly. But yeah, so thank you so much for taking time, current time out of your weekend to record for the show. I think I really respect and value your opinion, and I think that our conversations are always very enlightening, so I was glad that we could get one of them on tape.
Agreed.
On tape, as it
and
were.
Animated, I would say.
Oh yeah. Welcome to the show again. Very excited to chat with you this week.
I'm excited to be here.
Wonderful. And you're recording from half the country away, which is in itself a technological marvel. That's pretty fun.
Indeed.
Today we're talking about infantilization in the modern age, you know, in children's media, which is a topic that you actually proposed to us initially, and then we did some of the background on it to get up to speed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what did you think in your looking into it?
I'm wondering, well, and to clarify for those that haven't the literature on it, will you sort of explain the gist of what we're addressing today?
Of course. My extensive research is almost entirely limited to Facebook videos, but I will say, thank you. I always check my sources. I will say that one of the videos that I've seen recently was talking about how different studios in the modern age, specifically Disney, have changed the proportions of their female, specifically main characters, to more closely resemble the proportions of children, while their ages remain static. So someone like Cinderella is supposed to be, I believe, in her early 20s. Mm-hmm. And she has more or less relatively realistic proportions. Obviously, there's always going to be the Disney tiny waist and the big eyes. But she's much closer to a real human than, say, Moana or Merida, who have really, really big heads.
Giant
and
heads.
Tiny bodies.
I have a big head and little arms, like in Meet the Robinsons.
Indeed. And now I'm like, was that an entire expose? Now I'm questioning my entire existence. But yes, Disney and animation in general, I believe it can be seen in other children's media right now, although I don't consume nearly as much of other children's media, are moving toward women who are women's ages and put in situations that women, or at least young women, would be going through, who look subconsciously, in the human subconscious, like children.
Right. And that, in essence, do you think, well, it's a lot to unpack because it's what are we pointing at here? What are we trying to get at here? I know that we talk about, and Kierna also talks about, how childlike appearances and small, you know, petite, like cute little facial traits, etc., can awaken the same part of our psyche as wanting to keep somebody safe, you know, wanting to keep, to protect something. And that, for whatever reason, translates into attraction in a lot of scenarios, which is fascinating.
Exactly. And you're definitely getting at what I was wanting to talk about, which was pedophilia in the modern age. Is it something that men and women are being conditioned toward? especially as we're seeing the Me Too movement. I mean, the Terry Crews's harasser just resigned based on what had happened. And I don't know if you saw that note, but it is absolutely insane to read. Are we as a culture sexualizing children? And I don't know. I thought it was something interesting to talk about because it, I don't know. And see, that's the thing. Is it that we're just hearing more about pedophilia and molestation because we are in a more enlightened age? Or is it actually becoming more prevalent?
Mm. And that is, for me, that's it, scientifically, if you're looking at data sets, right, to try and trend this out and figure out, suss out what direction we're trending, it's also a time-sensitive thing. You know what I mean? We can't mm-hmm. continue in this, whatever direction we're going, we cannot continue in that vein because these past couple years of exposés and victims coming forward and court cases and you know, the Bill Cosby shit, like all of these sexual, non-consensual sexual depravity instances that have just seared through headlines these past couple years. It's something's got to give. It's unconscionable. It's an unconscionable, it's just unacceptable for our country and for any country that claims to lead in the modern age.
Absolutely agreed. Well, and that's a further question, right? Is it something that we're creating internally within our society? And, you know, the debate comes up time and time again. Violent video games create violence. Do they or don't they? And I'm surprised to not be hearing more about something similar in regards to children's programming, because especially when we're looking at cosplayers and mm-hmm. the growth of the princess party, I see it very, very frequently, at least in my social media circles, that women my age are dressing as these characters. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to necessarily get into like, is a certain type of clothing provocative or not provocative?
Right.
But
that is, you know, a gray area. Like, yeah, Cinderella was asking like, for it. You know what I mean?
Exactly. I don't I don't know about that.
Right.
But, you know, rule 42, right? If there's something that exists, the internet is going to create porn
right.
of it. And I think it's exceptionally interesting to think about specifically loli porn, Lolita porn.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you're familiar at all, and I won't make you answer.
Okay.
But I would never ask for you to tell me. But for those of us in the world who don't know what Lolita porn is, it is pornography specifically created to showcase feminine forms that are very, very young.
Yeah.
And specifically, this happens a lot in like the anime circuit. And it's something you can see in like Sailor Moon.
Big time.
Yeah, like the chibi artists
thing.
And exactly. Or on High School Host Club and all of our favorites.
Right.
We are seeing them in sexual situations, and there have been a lot of talks about whether or not Lolita porn should be considered
child porn.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know where I fall on that, but I think it's exceptionally interesting to view in the lens of Disney creating
these googly-eyed
exactly.
protagonists. I'm not sure what drove that decision, because it seems to me as they're computer animation department got better and better and better. Like, there was a Honest trailer I heard that still cracks me up to this day. I think it was like about like Wreck-It Ralph, and it's like, from the studio that finally figured out how to make Pixar films. Like, it's so true. They were just like, oh yeah, Pixar, yeah, hang out at our house. Yeah, how did you do that, by the mm-hmm. way? How'd you make Toy Story? But they finally figured out, they you know, it's almost on par with what Pixar's doing. Narrative aside, because I think Pixar's narratives, I think a lot of people would agree that Pixar's narratives are above and beyond because they spend more time on it.
Beyond compare.
Right.
It's absolutely beyond compare.
But It seems like their animation got hyper real and then their characters just became surreal just randomly. Like, you know what I mean? Like the golden age of the princess. That's what makes it odd with a princess franchise as a whole, I think, with Disney right now. I think they're in an interesting chapter for that franchise because it very much is a franchise. It's very much, they make no secret that it's their biggest moneymaker. Their biggest moneymaker, hands down. You know, Star Wars and Marvel aside. But, I mean, cheating. You see the merch, and the merch just doesn't match up. You know what I mean? Like, when they try and make a Giselle animated, you know, version that is matching their golden age, or they're trying to make a Moana that's animated, or they're trying to translate Elsa and Anna to a 2D format, and it just something looks a little bit eerie to me because the proportions, like you said, are just it's a completely different style, it's a completely different era, and it's interesting to me that they still market the two hand in hand because they're entirely different. Well, and then there's also like, it was so interesting too to see it expand to Megara from Hercules, because she is by definition not a princess. Correct me if I'm wrong, but she's not a princess. And she is definitely like a vamp, very much a vamp character. And we had the privilege of attending a Susan Egan masterclass back at school, and she's just an incredible actress. But I mean, Megara, and she said, is based on, you know, those 1920s vamps. And same with Jessica Rabbit, you know what I mean? Like, so Disney definitely, they've shown that they're not above intensely sexualizing a female protagonist or antagonist, and they just slowly fold those in and blur the lines between the Cinderella, Snow White, Sleeping Beauties, and the Jessica Rabbits, and the Megaras, and, you know, these doe-eyed new renditions from the last 5 to 10 years. Yeah.
Well, and I think you brought up something, if you were finished with your point,
Chris.
Oh,
yeah, no, of course.
I think you bring up an interesting point, which is the acquisition of Pixar. And I think that it's a huge counter-argument to say, well, they can't create realistic-looking human forms because not only is it not their brand, but it would fall into the uncanny valley. Right. And for people who are not familiar with what the uncanny valley is, the uncanny valley is a...
it's why you hated the Polar Express so much, everyone.
Yes, that is why you hated it. It's why Shrek failed when it was originally being audience tested, because Fiona specifically had been rendered so realistically that children were crying.
Oh, God. I forgot about that.
Children were crying in the theaters because Fiona was too real. It's the sense that you get when you can't quite tell if something is reality or unreality. It's something that I get a lot when I'm looking at the screenshots of the new Spider-Man game, where they'll show a picture of New York's skyline and then they'll show Spider-Man's skyline. And I truly cannot tell which is the real picture and which is not. And it's very unsettling. It's a deep, unsettling feeling. And as an animator, you have to make the decision of, okay, should I animate this as close to reality as possible? We have these amazing tools nowadays that can create things that look more like reality than our current reality, but it will make people uncomfortable. And so I think that's a counter argument to this idea that I'm sort of putting out there. I just don't buy it. I feel like another counter argument would be that they're appealing to their demographic. And I think that's, you know, the sort of Occam's razor of the situation. They're appealing to the demographic that they want to participate in viewing the film by creating a main character that looks like the demographic that they're marketing
right,
toward. They're like, wow, I got very lost in this.
Oh yeah, no, it's a child adult that they sort of have created, which in itself is not as lascivious as we might necessarily trend toward on the show in theorizing that it is an intentional sort of like Well, sex sells, and also fairy tales sell. So let's combine these. Let's see if we can take out two birds with one stone. Yeah, it's interesting, but I think as we are touching on an interesting transition into what Uncanny Valley's role in video games, because I too have seen the Spider-Man ads a lot, and I saw one across a restaurant I think recently, and it took me a good the whole commercial to be like, is this a live action film? Are they? Is there a new Spider-Man movie? Is it already coming out? I don't know, you know, we're only getting more and more advanced in our, you know, in cell shading and picture quality and animation modeling, and motion capture is just practically a standard now in the industry, which in itself is a very interesting thing. It's so common. Like it used to be a luxury. It used to be like, you remember L.A. Noir when it came out. L.A. Noir,
oh,
right?
Yes, and now it's like a meme. Now it's a joke. Like, look how dumb this looks.
They're like, we thought this was worthy of our time and money. But when it came out, we were like, oh, you can tell if they're lying or if they're telling the truth. This is real Hollywood actors playing these roles. It was right when Mad Men was hot, and it has those Mad Men guys in it. It was incredible, and it was unsettling because of its realism. And I think, honestly, I think Rockstar as a studio has trended away from that valley that they sort of sought for that game, in my experience, like with Saints Row the Third and the new GTAs and whatnot, as far as like how their clothing looks and how like their skin textures and gestures and whatnot. Like they're still creating a kick-ass game, but I think they find more pleasure now in a slightly more cartoony rendition of reality, because I think it can be wearing on people. We talk a lot as gamers, we talk a lot about how wrongfully accused the industry becomes about violence in video games, sort of correlating with real world violence and how the metrics are just non-existent.
Absolutely.
But I imagine on a just interpersonal psychological scale, if you're playing as very, very hyper realistic looking characters, and you're seeing, I don't know, you're killing police, or you're police are killing you, or you're slapping around prostitutes, or you know what I mean, or you're just shooting like someone that's your friend for most of the game, and when he turns on you at the end of San Andreas, you know, it can probably wear on someone, you know what I mean? I'm sorry if I ruined San Andreas for anyone out there.
No, I can tell how deeply that affected you, and I'm sorry for your loss. You know,
I am not very good at hiding my own trauma with it, but it was your friend, well, and he trusted you.
light, I suppose-ish, Spider-Man spoilers, but there was actually a point where I had to step away. My husband, who we'll hear from later in the body of work that you're doing,
right,
Chris,
he'll be on the show.
He was playing Spider-Man, as you do with a video game, and there was this section where a terrorist attack occurred, and you play as a character going back into the fray to search for a survivor. And it was absolutely so stressful to me that I had to physically step away, because it was so real. It was done so realistically, and the time and the care and the attention being paid to the voice acting and the physicality, and you know, it was almost entirely, I wouldn't say almost entirely. There were combinations of quick time events and real gameplay, but the gameplay is just so realistic to begin with. It's not that Final Fantasy X, like, wow, look at these beautiful pre-rendered cutscenes, and then like, you know, 16-bit.
Oh God, drag the Beyonce.
That's not Final Fantasy X.
Drag Final Fantasy. That annoys me so much. I'm like, even when they had it for mobile recently, when they came to mobile, and you saw the beautiful ads, and you saw some like pseudo, what ended up being just like pre-recorded gameplay sequences. I was like, cinematic sequences. I was like, if this game is this beautiful on mobile, I will play it. But I, in my experience, it's never been the case. There's like such a rift between what they that franchise markets and what they deliver. But anyways, continue. Yeah, no, it seems like it would. It's an emotional barrage, and all of us remember the Call of Duty is issue, that whole scandal. And I still to this day am surprised that they went in the direction they did in having that you fight as an insurgent terrorist. And this is only a few years after 9/11. This was like during the war on terror, right?
It was an absolutely unprecedented call. And true, it was certainly less than a decade.
Yeah.
No, it could have been more than a decade.
You think so? You think it was 2011 or later? I think that it was before we went to college. I think it was in high school.
You're right. So you're right. It was before we went.
Yeah, so it was like the late.
Gosh, it must have been like 2008,
2007
or six.
Yeah. Just like a few years after the actual attacks, but still in the heat of the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War, which we're still involved in. It's still a timely and very close to home reality that they presented, and you were the bad guy. You were the terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
It was such a strange choice and so surreal to watch.
I just looked that up. It came out in 2014.
Okay, phew. But still, yeah, 13 years after, and you're a terrorist. Yeah, the hyper-realism in games. Well, the hyper-realism and the violence in games is getting so authentic. Like, I'm like cheers to you guys. The physical mapping, you know what I mean? Like, with the mocap, etc. For what was the spiritual successor to Heavenly Sword? Hellblade. So Hellblade, the violence in Hellblade is just sensational. Like, cheers to you guys. But I imagine it would be very draining after a long time, in contrast to a game that we've played through a lot and well, more so backseated as played through Bloodborne and the Dark Souls series. The violence in there is quite intensive, but it's still very theatrical, you know what I mean? It's still very gamey.
Yeah, there's almost an elegance and a reverence to it because of the difficulty that you have to have and the reverence and the respect that you have to have for your opponent. Like, I feel like it's a little different from the like shoot 'em up games like GTAs where you can just slice through them like butter. And it's reflected in the art style. The art style is very effete and it not necessarily grounded in reality, but more so in reality than something like a GTA, than something like, I mean, oh God, what was the game? Doom. Like Doom. Doom was fantastic, right. But it was purposefully overblown.
They know what they're doing. They're like, all right, the story is thin. The story is very thin. You're just a Marine that wakes up in hell, basically, and you have to fight your way out. And that's it's a fundamental game to it created the first person shooter genre. Yeah, it was a sensational game, but very much knew what it was. And it wasn't looking to, you know, send you on a drug trip where you think that you're actually looking at a demon and you're actually seeing a person be eviscerated by a demon. So that's interesting, too. Yeah, I just thought I'd just take a small detour and chat and gauge your thoughts on where we're going with video game animation. I think that a similar peak was met with titles like L.A. Noire. And then now we're doing a respectable pullback a little bit. I just ordered a PS4, and one of the first games that I want to play on it is God of War, which is, to my understanding, is very high. It's hyper-realistic looking, but also the color scheme is how they skew it. You know what I mean? And how they make it more florid and how they make it more lush than anything in reality could be, and that gives it that fantasy element. So I'm very excited to see a best of both worlds sort of scenario over with that game. But back to
well and in terms of the topic that we've been exploring, I feel like video games have fallen far more into the reality spectrum or representing humans in a more realistic way, and you do for to a certain extent, see unreal figures like in MMOs, but usually this is something that you as a player can create. The big titles lately have been God of War and Call of Duty and
the Division,
like these AAA titles.
Watch Dogs.
Yeah, they're the very realistic view of the human form, contrasted with, in previous decades, the very cartoonish Banjo-Kazooie and
Spyro,
Conker's Bad Fur Day, and we're looking at a much more, because video game systems were inherently toys. Mm. They were made for
right.
children, and they have aged up with their demographic.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think it's interesting to see Disney doing the opposite thing, seeing animation in terms of television and movies going in the opposite direction. We're aging our protagonists mm-hmm. down instead of aging them up.
Yeah. And yeah, I guess it's just two opposite approaches to selling, right? I mean, it's two opposite approaches mm-hmm. to gaining an art audience. Maybe it's a pointing to something bigger in 2018. Maybe in 2018, the kids' purchasing power in a household is way higher than it was in the early 2000s or in the 90s even. You know what I mean? The idea, we have these parents that just want to give their children everything. And Disney does a great job of prepackaging that. You know what I mean? They, if you get X amount of tickets to Disney parks, and if you get a hotel on property, and if you do the princess hair salon or whatnot, you're guaranteed X amount of memories. You know what I mean? That, like, you're guaranteed mm-hmm. a very particularly catered experience for a price, but you're guaranteed a good time, which is something that's not easy to do, I don't think, in the modern travel
truly
world.
Well, and I don't think it can be understated how amazing the Disney experience
right.
is. Like, for all of this pontification, I think it's important to talk about how amazing it is to visit a Disney park and to visit any Disney location, any Disney store. It is perfectly curated mm-hmm. in order to give you the best time possible. I used to work at a Disney store, and one of the jokes is that there's no better place to get injured than a Disney park, because they will do anything they have to in order to make sure you have a magical
right.
experience. And so my cousin, actually, when she was very young, vomited in a Disney park because she had a sensitive stomach, and was taken to the Disney infirmary and was given all manner of free experiences. And, oh no, we're so sorry that this happened to you. Have this character dinner for free. Enter the park an hour early.
Wow.
Like, they go above and beyond in order to make sure that you have the experience you pay for. And I think that that's amazing. Working in a customer service field now, Disney is absolutely unparalleled in terms of the customer experience. But I think it's just so odd to see how their art style has changed, and you can track it. I mean, if you think about three touch points, Cinderella, who looks very womanly and is mm-hmm. in her 20s, Jasmine, who has the most exaggerated proportions of the 90s
truly.
Princesses, as far as I can tell. Just the tiny, tiny, tiny waist and giant
and like
eyes.
A miniature non-existent nose.
Yes, she's very, very exaggerated in terms of her proportions. And then a Moana or a Merida or even an Elsa, Anna,
or a Tangled.
Rapunzel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tangled.
Or one of the Tangleds.
Well, when you didn't
Tango.
Wouldn't people, I remember you telling stories of people just like pointing at dolls and saying what the movie was called instead of the dolls. Is that true?
Yes.
They're like,
it was
Tangled,
absurd.
Please.
I would like one Brave.
Like a Brave.
People, it was actually really endearing to have adults come in and ask for, can I get the Brave horse?
Can I get the horse from Brave?
They would want the horse from Brave.
The Tangled horse, please.
Can I please get that weird frog from Tangled?
Weird frog.
Ma'am, that's a chameleon.
It's a chameleon. You look very tired. I'm sorry that this has happened to you. That's so funny. I would crack up working there. But the bar is very high. And even like retail wise, the replenishment of their displays is bananas. That was like across the industry, even across retail industry, it was like spoken of in hushed tones. They're like, at Disney, they have to be razor sharp shoulder folds, and they take rulers to the stacks, and they must be a certain amount of shirts high. But they wrote the book on customer service and customer experience, and they continue to lead the way. This is just an interesting, just a sort of interesting porthole into where they're going next and what they're trying to communicate to us in the moment. And
Well, and I'd like to take a look at Incredibles.
I was just thinking about that,
because Incredibles is something from my childhood, right? And from your childhood, I imagine. There were a lot of memes going around on social media that were like, I'll punch a kid if they're in the way and I need to go see
Incredibles 2.
Yeah. It's my movie. And I just think it's so interesting that Disney, I don't feel, doubled down on that being our generation's
really?
Movie. And in contrast, well, have you seen it?
Yeah.
I really don't feel like they doubled down on that being a movie for me.
Okay.
I do feel like it was a children's movie, whereas something like Toy Story 3 was made for an adult audience. Children can enjoy it, but that was for
same
me.
Same with Monsters University. So it's interesting that. Mm-hmm. Well, how do you think they did with Finding Dory?
You know I saw it, and I'm really okay. They went to the aquarium, and okay, got it. I'm back. Okay, I feel like Finding Dory sort of fell into the Incredibles 2 bucket, where it was very appealing for children and didn't quite scratch that itch for an adult audience that had seen Finding Nemo and wanted that
more of that story. Well, I think their storytelling changed so much in between that period too. I think it's a miracle that even Finding Dory and the Incredibles are even a semblance of their parent franchise, because they changed probably a completely different staff by the time it gets to those spiritual successors. With Incredibles 2, I remember thinking what struck me as the adult elements was that they engaged with the challenges of parenthood and the daily conflicts of parenthood and fighting, arguing in front of your children, arguing in public is something that they really tackle, I think, quite fearlessly in that franchise.
Well, and I do very much respect the representation of an imperfect family. I think we can agree that Mrs. Incredible, Elastigirl, is given more of a position of power in this movie than in the previous one. And that becomes a source of dispute within the household. Mr. Incredible, Bob, is, I don't know why I know his first name.
Parr,
we're very close, I guess. Bob becomes very jealous of her. And I think that is a very adult issue to tackle. And so I really do appreciate that. But I just feel like it didn't do the same thing that Toy Story 3 did. Maybe it's just a preference thing. Maybe it's not something I can quantify. But, when your expectations are so high for a film, it inevitably won't be met. And Incredibles 2 was the anticipated movie. So many people loved the Incredibles franchise. Yeah, I don't know. It didn't feel like it was for me as much as it was for the kids in the audience, which is awesome. Obviously, that's their demographic. But I think it's really interesting to see that they're not doubling down on our demographic, who are avid Disney fanatics.
Right. I mean, I'm headed to Disney Tokyo in like a month or so. I'm giving them all my money that I have saved for so long.
Yes, indeed. yeah, I just think it's a very interesting call, and I think it's a very interesting thing to see, especially because, you know, the people who are a few years older than us, I know many of my coworkers have their own children, and they're watching Disney movies with their right. children. And I just think it's so interesting that maybe that's their demographic. Maybe it's that they're trying to create movies that are like the princess films that you and I grew up with, but are appealing to that younger audience to draw them in for right. the future instead of just doing the same
and
thing.
It's, I think it also, in conclusion, I think that it, it's a bit of a, by definition, it's a bit of a nostalgic trauma, if you will, in seeing something that was such a beautiful part of your growing up and was such an influential part of how you enjoyed art and storytelling, sort of like being like, all right, and it's what they touch on in Toy Story 3, where they're like, all right, it's time to give the toys away. It's time to move forward. And so I think it'll be exciting to see how Disney's able to reach out to us as adults rather than just through our children and appealing to our younger natures. I wonder, you know, perhaps with the Marvel and Star Wars acquisitions, they'll try and beat that drum, I don't know, into shape. But I'm also excited to see what we find on our own, you know, in the coming years, as far as studios and storytellers and mediums that continue to speak to us and inspire us. And let's just hope that they don't inspire any strange sexual perversions that get anyone in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I do want to be clear. I don't want to kink shame.
Oh, yeah.
But there's certainly a line, right?
It's a legal
and,
line, yeah. It's the law.
It is very clearly drawn in the law. And I just, I think it's such a scary place to be in terms of attraction, because especially as a young girl, you know, just inherently, not inherently, but you're taught through reinforcement, societal expectation, etc., that these are the pinnacle of beauty. These are the pinnacle of femininity. And to see the pinnacle of femininity be represented with a four-year-old's proportions is very worrisome for me.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think that that is a hashtag less popular opinion, because it's scary to go toe-to-toe with the giant that is Disney. But I thank you for coming on and honestly on the show and sharing that outlook and sort of bringing to light, you know, an intrigue, at the very least, a very intriguing trend and something that we should be paying attention to regardless of what the underpinnings are. So thank you so much for coming on the show. Yeah, I look
thank
forward
you.
To seeing you guys in person shortly, and I definitely look forward to having your husband Buzzbend on the show. It's gonna be a blast. That's all good.
That's all, folks.